The process of science to me, like, yeah, it's like you wake up on Christmas morning and you go under the tree and you open up, you know, a box, right? And then that box, right, there's a little bit of a present, and but there's another box in the box. And so he's like, oh, okay, this stuff is cool, but what's in this other box? And you open up that box and there's like, you know, some other little trinkets, and you're like, oh, this is really cool. But then there's another box in that box, and it's just endless boxes inside of boxes, each of which has their own little prize, but each of which also has another box in it.
Hey, everybody. It's been about 2 years since I've made one of these intros. But if there's ever been a time to look at some of the small or big good things that make our what the fuck world worth living in, I think now during a global pandemic would be the time. How's everybody holding up? Yeah, this stuff's starting to get tough. I'm an introvert, and I typically yearn for the life of a monk, just reading and meditating and going on long introspective walks. And even I'm getting sick of this. I'd love to just hear a drunk person yell a bad conversation at me right now. So, why am I back? Well, I stopped producing At Least There's This in 2018 to focus on a new show I was then creating called Science, the Show, where myself and my co-host bring scientists and stand-ups together to create a night of laughter and learning and try to break down some of the barriers people feel around science. In making Science the Show, I've met some amazing people I've wanted to interview for a long time, but there hasn't been a great opportunity. Well, Science the Show is a live show, and now is not the best time for live comedy. We've transitioned to doing live streams on Twitch, and the show will go on, but it's still freed up a lot of time for me to get back into making At Least There's This. So I'll be trying to bring you some great interviews about some of the small good things from some of these amazing people I've met. I'm going to try to get these out regularly over the next couple of months, but the world's crazy right now, so I can't promise any hard or fast cadence. Anyway, I'm really proud of this episode. It's with one of my favorite scientists and favorite people, and I hope you guys enjoy me talking to Shane. Hello and welcome back, I guess, or for the first time, to At Least There's This, a podcast about some of the small good things in, in our world. I have not done this podcast since 2018. I reached a place where I was happy to end what I guess you could call season one, but it's 2020, and the world is more of a mess than it's ever been. A beautiful, wonderful, stinky mess. We are living in the middle of quarantine, which has been rough on a lot of people. So rough that Kim Jong-un, I think, just died, and no one really had any attention span for it. But in a world where a global dictator can die and no one can even notice, at least there's
evolution.
I am joined by someone I'm so excited to be talking with. I'm with professor, podcaster, doctor, host, lover of the world and knowledge. Kids love him. Parents will too. Shane Campbell Staton.
That was the most amazing intro I think I've ever gotten in anything in my entire life.
Quick bit of me blowing smoke up your ass. I haven't done this podcast since 2018. I know Shane from this show that I do that has sort of taken over my creative life called Science the Show, where myself and my two co-hosts, Russell Cohen-Hoffing and Dylan Farr, who are also former guests of At Least There's This, bring scientists to the stage with comedians to introduce our audience to their own friendly neighborhood scientist. I met Shane doing that show. He did our show. And from then, I knew if I ever did bring back At Least There's This, I would want Shane to be the first guest.
Awesome, man. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, glad you're here too. So the question I like to start everybody off on is, would you, Shane, describe yourself as an optimist or a pessimist?
You start with the small questions, I see. Optimist, you know, I think at the end of the day, I have to consider myself an optimist. But like, I guess like a nihilistic optimist in the sense that like, you know, everything's probably going to go to hell. So yeah, you might as well do what makes you happy kind of thing.
What? Okay, I think I want to crack into that. So is that like that's a local in your own time frame, everything's gonna go
I
to
think
hell?
It's an ultimate thing, right? So I mean, if we keep going the way we're going, it might be within my lifetime. I hope not. You know, but I mean, the thing is, I mean, the one thing that we know about life is that, you know, things come and go, you know, and I think that at the end of the day, we're going to be one of the things that, you know, we were one of the things that came, and ultimately we're going to be one of the things that go. So, you know, might as well enjoy it while you're here.
So how does that look like optimism to you? I guess, would you describe how would you describe optimism versus pessimism then?
Yeah. So I think I guess that does sound pessimistic, you know, but I think at the end of the day, right, knowing that you only have so much time, like we only have so much time as a species. I only have so much time as an individual. You know, why not create as much good and as little time as possible, you know, and then see what happens from there.
Okay. Yeah. I think I'm following. Can you maybe talk me through what that would look like to you locally? Like what sorts of good are you creating? What sorts of good do you see people creating in the world that make you feel that way or that make you want to work towards that?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think at the end of the day, you know, the thing that is most important to me, and I think one of the things that is probably most empowering for all individuals is truth, right? There's like the whole personal truth thing, but then, you know, for me at least, it's like a quantitative, like reproducible, tangible understanding of what the universe is and what this strange thing that we call life is, both, you know, in a personal sense and also in a greater sort of species wide or, you know, biology wide sense.
That, I guess, takes us perfectly into the meat and potatoes of the conversation. We're here to talk about evolution. Do you want to really quickly let anybody who's listening know what you do for a living?
Yeah, so I am a professor of evolutionary biology. I am trained as an evolutionary biologist. And I study evolution, but I study it on pretty rapid time frames. So I study how we as a species act as an engine for the evolutionary process, mostly in other species around the planet and all the different ways that we do, right? From, you know, all the different aspects of our culture, behavior, et cetera, that can drive the evolutionary process in other species.
Can you give me like an example of a species that we've changed in some way?
So I'll give you the example that I'm working on right. Well, one of the examples I'm working on right now. One of the things that we're studying is the evolution of tusk loss in elephants in response to poaching in Africa specifically. This particular story takes place in a very specific place in Gorongosa National Park in Mozambique. And the story there is like from the late 70s to the early 90s, there was a civil war in Mozambique. And during that time, there was, you know, large scale hunting of wildlife. And a big part of that was for the wildlife trade. And that basically fueled this conflict. And during that time, most of the large mammals, you know, were wiped out. Over 90% of most large mammal species were wiped out, including over 90% of the elephants in this region. But after the war in the early 90s, when people came back into the park, they realized that there was actually a really large proportion of female elephants specifically that were born without their tusks and never grew their tusks, which is typically very, very rare. It's a female-specific trait in African elephants, but typically it only occurs at like 1% to 2%. But after the war, there was half of the surviving females were essentially tuskless. So we're trying to understand exactly what led to the evolution of this tusk loss, what are the genes involved, and what it might mean for you know, these ecosystems that elephants play such a critical role for.
So what about that excites you, right? Like, I can understand what would excite Shane the scientist. Is it the same thing that excites you as a person, or are there different things at play that you find exciting Shane the human I know you can't, right, pull the human versus the scientist. You're one and the same. But is there something maybe almost like emotional that excites you about that story?
Yeah. So, I mean, everything I do is basically through the lens of, science. You know, like me as an individual, you know, me as a scientist, I mean, it's the same person. You know, is there anything that, I find the challenge intellectually exciting. And I think the idea that there is still such a really, there's like such an interesting mystery left unsolved, right? Despite how long people have been fascinated with elephants, how long people have been studying elephants, observing elephants, the fact that there's this pretty big mystery left that I get a chance to solve personally, I think that really excites me. You know, the project itself is sad, and it certainly weighs on me, you know, as an individual, just like psychologically, like the idea of, you know, elephants being killed for their teeth, of all things. You know, it weighs on me. But then also there's the excitement of the actual work. You know, I mean, this collecting the data for this project is probably the single most exciting adventure of my entire life. And it all started just really randomly. Like the whole process was just really exciting to me. I mean, essentially, I'd never worked on elephants before this project. I typically work on lizards.
Which are not elephants, right?
Which are not, that is correct.
Okay, great. I've learned something.
Yes, yes, you have. Yeah, I mean, I typically work on not elephants, but I saw, of all things, I saw this YouTube video about these tuskless elephants of Gorongosa, and that led me down this weird rabbit hole of, you know, sending emails to people who I knew studied elephants, and they forward me to other people, and somewhere along the way, I got invited to Gorongosa to, you know, actually investigate this thing. So,
did you ever see this as the kind of thing you would be doing with your life, like flying around the world, studying evolution, like solving mysteries about how things exist?
No, and that's because I think, well, one, what I do is very strange, right? There's like, you if you ask somebody what a doctor does, you got a pretty good understanding. If you ask somebody, you know, what a dentist does, you know, if you ask somebody what an evolutionary biologist does, I mean, it kind of leaves, there's a lot of question marks there, you know. You know, I never really saw myself as a scientist growing up. You know, I mean, I was raised in the hood in South Carolina, and you know, I never did the whole like hiking thing or like splashing around in vernal pools, all the stuff that typically you hear how biologists got into biology is through doing those sorts of things. I never had that. But I got into it through television. So, you know, and then that case, like seeing dudes like Steve Irwin and Jeff Corwin travel the world, like, you know, messing with critters. And there's something that always fascinated me for sure, but nothing I ever thought I'd ever actually be able to do.
Why evolutionary biology then, right? You say you grew up, you weren't going out in nature a lot. TV was the thing that got you excited about it. These people messing with animals, but like TV could have gotten you excited about physics. TV could have gotten you excited about chemistry. But it seems like you got bit by the biology. I mean, bugs are biological, you know, so that's redundant, but you got bit by biology.
I think for me, it really was like the animals themselves that just fascinated me. Specifically for me, it was reptiles. I don't know what it was. It was something about, you know, just like the ancientness of these like scaly animals, right? Things that they look really crazy. They do all these crazy things. Like, you know, some have turned their saliva into venom. You know, some have modified their ribs into like makeshift wings so that they can glide from place to place.
That scares the hell out of me. Like the snake that can fly.
Yeah.
You're not supposed
exactly,
to do that.
Right? If you choose one thing and stick to it, right?
Like, you're a snake. Snake.
I mean, and then like some of them are just like gargantuan, right? Things like crocodilians, right? Komodo dragons. You know, it was just, you know, it's something that you see in like an adventure movie, right? And the fact that these things like actually exist in all these amazing places in like the far corners of the world, it was, I don't know what it was about it, but it was something that just really intrigued me.
But more than it intrigued you, you didn't just want to be a biologist, you wanted to be an evolutionary biologist.
Yeah.
So there's something about the process, right? Something about how did this become this way seems to have excited you, right? And you even see that with the Gorongosa thing, where it's like, why is this happening? Do you think you can put a finger on what that is? Like, why that excites you?
I feel like that's like a question like my psychiatrist would ask me.
I hope I'm covered by your insurance.
I don't know if my insurance can afford you, honestly.
Yeah, I'm pretty pricey. Just the price of friendship.
Which is priceless. Wait, what was the question? Oh, why? Why evolution specifically?
Yeah, why the changes, the mutability. So like there, biology is a, while I love all sciences as like a science communicator, I find physics the easiest to wrap my head around, which is, you know, madness. Physics is insane. But like, it's easier for me, I think, to talk physics, and I know more about like what the landscape of physics looks like. I know very little about biology, but I imagine you could have been any number of types of biologist, not evolutionary. That's true. Necessarily.
But for me, you know, I think going into biology, because I went into it with a very specific lens, which was like very like creature oriented, that meant that like a lot of things, at least in the outset, just didn't really appeal to me all that much. It's funny because a lot of those things are stuff that I do all the time now. You know, but I wasn't really interested in like molecular biology, things that happened at the cellular level. Like it wasn't anything that really caught me, you know, it wasn't anything that really like held my attention. But the idea of trying to understand like how an organism came to be, right? And this sort of grand story of like this one process that links everything that has ever existed that we can say has been alive, linked by this one thread, right? This process of evolution. Something about that was really interesting to me. And then that interest sort of evolved, I guess, as I continued to study.
Yeah, I'm getting like a theme in a couple of things that I've heard you say, and it has to do with like long time, right? You're interested in reptiles and crocodilians because they've been around forever, right? There's something about like the long scope of time, which is almost there's like a fun mirroring to it, because now you study how humans are causing evolution, which is the short term, but it's like, how are humans part of this long term process that's been happening since life emerged on the planet?
Yeah, I mean, and I think one of the intriguing things to me is that, you know, it's still the same process, right? And, you know, so for one, like in terms of understanding our long-term impacts on this planet, right? I mean, evolution is a really interesting lens, you know, to understand like the human footprint, generally speaking. Like what happens when we're all dead and gone? Like, you know, our footprint, what we did to this place in the organisms, right? It's going to stay around for a while. You know, I mean, we've had as much of an impact on this planet as essentially just the five major extinctions, right? Besides those events, nothing else has really had the sort of impact on this planet in such a short period of time as we have. You know, we've been around what, life generally about 3.5 billion years, right? And then 200,000 years ago, modern human shows up and then throws things into disarray, right? And everything gets shuffled around because of us. Things go extinct because of us on a really ridiculous time scale. And then the things that are around are changing. They're changing in their behavior, their morphology, their physiology, etc. And these are impacts that are just going to keep moving right into the future. But the flip side of that is that looking at these particular types of events also gives us a really interesting understanding of what that fundamental process of evolution is, All right, this thing that is, it's actually really hard because it's, it, you know, typically we think about it and it's been studied over these really long time periods. It's really hard to know, like, you know, okay, these are two species. At some point they shared a common ancestor. What happened in between? When, but when they've been separate species for millions of years, right, understanding, right, the early part of that process can be very difficult. But in the cases of, you know, human mediated evolution, right, I mean, the beginning of the process is right now. So we can dive in and like really look at the mechanisms and tear things, tear the puzzle apart in a way, right, and look at the individual components in such a fashion that's actually really hard to do otherwise.
I don't think as long as I've known you, I've ever seen you that animated, right, as you were just saying it. So I want to ask, like, knowing this, being, let me give you a mental image of all my scientist friends, right? I have this, like, Pokedex now of dear friends who are all scientists. And to me, it looks like all of you are all just, like, at the edge of the ontology bubble, right? Shoving your faces as hard into, like, you know, the bendy bubble material as you can, trying to, like, pop through. And it sounds like that's sort of what you're talking about right now. There's this thing, this question that you didn't know the answer to, and now you kind of know the answer. Or not the answer, but at least you have, like, some image into it. Is there... What does that feel like to you, the embodied person, as you're looking at this thing that might be, it might take you a long time day to day, it might be a little tiring, but like, what's that feeling that drives this? What does it feel like to be looking at this process that's so occluded, that we know so, at once so much about, it's so fundamentally important to us, but we also know so little, and you're like solving it, you're shoving your face into the ontology bubble?
Man, you asked like some really penetrating questions here.
Trying to get to that meat.
Yeah, gotta get even skip over the potatoes, even straight to the meat. It's interesting. It's for me to describe it. God, that's really hard to describe. I would say it's a combination of incredible excitement, but also like complete terror.
Terror
at the yeah. I mean, because, you know, there's like this moment, there's always a moment, right, where, you know, you're going through like just the everyday, right, where you're, you know, trudging through your, you know, because it sounds like really, you know, really fancy to like, you know, go and study elephants. And it is, right, it's, you know, going around in helicopters and, you know, darting elephants and, you know, putting collars on sedated elephants, like all super exciting stuff, right? But then once we have like blood samples, for instance, right, I mean, basically, it's all looking at a computer, right? And you're looking at sequences, running statistics, looking at p-values, et cetera, trying to understand exactly what is going on. And that process, I mean, it takes months, right? Sometimes it takes years. And then at some critical point, right, you have everything set up and you're like ready to run the analysis, right? The analysis that's going to tell you if something is interesting there.
Do elephants exist?
Yeah. You know, or like, what is, you know, what is the gene that's responsible for tusk loss? Or, you know, is that like, can we see at the genetic level, like, can we see in the elephant genome this signature of hunting mediated selection? Like, can we see what we have done simply based on the patterns that exist in this species genome? And so it's all, you know, we've gone through that process, laid everything out, and then the equation is, you know, it's all set up, and then you just have to press enter, right? That's what's gonna happen. Yeah. You're gonna press enter, then you're gonna know something, or you're not gonna know something.
Oh, wow. That's terrifying.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That is terrifying. You know, especially when it's like years, right? Years is building up to a moment. And you're like, did I do this right? Is there something interesting here? Did I, you know, spend the last however long chasing a ghost? Did I make this all up? am I good enough to do this?
Yeah.
You start spiraling.
Right.
You know, and then you hit enter, and you know, when it turns out your way, it's like complete elation. And it when it doesn't, it goes the other way.
I part of the problem in making this podcast is that I end up like wanting to follow two paths at once. Right? Like, I want to right now talk about how much I love how human science is. That's why I do science communication. It's why I run Science the Show, right? Like, I have felt what you just described so many times about such mundane shit in my life. And I love that people are like, oh, scientists are this. And I'm like, no, scientists are, they're people who do great work, but they're folks, you know?
Yeah, man. Hey, we ain't nothing but some weirdos, dude. You know, it's all the same. Because the thing is, right, you ask any biologist on the planet, you walk up to them and you say, like, why do you do biology? Or like, why do you do science, generally speaking? What you will not hear ever, what you will never hear is like, I just really grew up loving p-values, and statistical significance is just the most important thing in my life. That's never going to happen. Right. I mean, and that's what a lot of people think about when they think about science, right? It's this sort of clean cut, you know, hypothesis testing and, you know, data quantification, et cetera. And it is all of those things, right? But it's a means to an end, right? Underneath all of that, right, there's like some like ridiculous passion. Right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Some what I call a, like a beautiful obsession that wakes people up in the middle of the night, certainly wakes me up in the middle of the night sometimes, you know, and it's. So yeah, I mean, it's just we're just people who do like really specific and very strange things.
Which, I mean, I feel like most people are. They just don't realize it.
Oh yeah.
But for you, this takes me back to a thing that I know is big for you, but it's about the story, right?
Yeah.
It's like, what is the story that we're a part of?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, and the thing, it's like evolution is. I mean, it is the story. Like every story you've ever been told, right, is scoped within evolution, right? I mean, it was a physicist, Carl Sagan, actually, right, in this Pale Blue Dot, you know, it's like every war that's ever been fought, you know, every lover's quarrel, every kiss, you know, every aspect of, you know, betrayal and cooperation, et cetera, like all of these things, like our collective experience, right, is all like those moments are just like little bits and pieces of this grander story that's been playing out for, you know, 3.5 billion years.
I want to start to narrow the focus now because we're talking about story. We're talking about evolution. We got to bring this down to talking about you, because what kind of storyteller would I be if I did not find the metaphor in this?
Okay. I'm not sure if I like where this is going.
You went into biology feeling a certain way. Mm-hmm. Has that changed, or has it changed who you are? Has your study of biology and evolution specifically changed who Shane the human is?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the thing is, you know, for me, it took me a really long time to get to a place where I could do what I do now. This is the only thing I can ever really remember myself wanting to do. But also at the same time, I was vastly unprepared for the journey, you know, that was going to be required for me to get here, which I guess is how like every quote unquote good story goes, right? You know, so for me, like I was raised in the South. You know, I did not have much of a science or math background at all going into college. And, you know, and then I walked into college and I was like, I think I want to do biology. And they were like, great, take your intro biology course, chemistry, calculus. Yeah. So, you know, they give me all my intro courses and I got steamrolled. I had no idea what was going on. I remember actually walking in like the very first day of my very first college biology class. You know, I had my college rule notebook. I was ready to go. You know, went and sat front and center. I was like, oh yeah, we about to do some biology in here.
In right my now. Mind, you're dressed like you're in the Fresh Prince. Like you're dressed like this is in the early 90s.
It was not in the early 90s.
I know, but I want to think of it that way.
But yeah, man, I mean, I was hyped. And then I sat down, you know, in the front of the class. And I'll never forget this for as long as I live. The very first thing out of this professor's mouth, he says, delta G equals delta H minus T delta S. And he writes this on the board, and which is like this equation is basically about entropy. But at the time, you know, so he writes this thing on the board. It's like a triangle, T, you know, and he sort of writes this whole thing out. And I'm just like, well, I didn't even know you could add and subtract shapes, number one. You know, I feel like you have to spell out the whole word if you want me to understand exactly what you're talking about. And then I look around and all the students are like, oh, yeah, delta D. Oh, yeah, of course. And, you know, and they're like scribbling stuff down. I'm like, am I late? Like, did I miss something? And it turns out what it was high school biology is what I had missed. Yeah, so I got steamrolled that first year. I finished my first year with a 0.65 GPA. It was, you know, one of the most devastating experiences of my entire life. And it's one thing if I had like gone to college and I was just like goofing off or something like that, you know. But I was working really hard. I just had no idea what I was doing. And, you know, so I remember after my first year, I went back home, you know, with like my tail tucked between my legs. And I was like, look, you know, mom, I tried this, you know, this is the only thing I've ever really wanted to do. I've tried it. I'm really bad at it. Like not even mediocre, but like real bad. And it was real expensive to do. Right. And I was like, maybe it's time for me to just, you know, try to, you know, get a job and just kind of start life. And, you know, she was like, you know, you can do that. You know, if that is what you decide is going to be the best thing for you, I will back your play. I will support you. But make sure that you're doing this because you think it's the right thing to do, right? And not doing it because you're scared of failing again, right? She says, she told me, you know, she was like, one of the hardest things in life is what if. Right. It's really hard to live with that sort of shadow following you for your entire life. And she's like, I know because I've got it, you know, and, you know, if this is what you want to do, right, you should think very, very carefully about whether or not you're willing to, you know, if you really want to give that up so soon. You know, so I had the whole summer and, you know, I like sat in my room for a couple weeks and, you know, kind of moped to myself and, you know, cried lightly. And then finally, you know, I was like, okay, if I'm not going to do this, what am I going to do? But I could never come up with an answer. And always came back to biology for whatever reason. And so I went to my high school, got the high school textbooks and, you know, started reading over the summer, went back and doubled down on the classes and then kept trudging forward. You know, it was a slow journey, but eventually I got there and, you know, finished my bachelor's in 5 years instead of four, took an extra year to study for all my standardized tests and then did my PhD at Harvard.
Yeah. And that there, here you are, Professor Shane.
Yeah, you know, doing a thing.
And it's like, okay. So you kind of brought up Campbell's story structure, you know, like starts out, you're not prepared. You get prepared, you get some learning from a wise person. The gift you get at the end, I feel like, isn't so much position as it is like understanding. You wanted to know this stuff, and now you know this stuff. And like, how does it feel to be... I like hanging out with scientists because even though there are so many scientists, and you guys all know different stuff. For instance, we share a friend, Russell, who knows there is like a tiny subset of the psychology of the way that your pupils work that he is one of the only people that really knows and understands. right? And like, it's not this huge thing. It will be a big part, you know, science is cumulative, but there's this little thing that he knows more than just about anybody else. And he'll like add to that as his career as a scientist goes on. How does it feel being one of those people?
Amazing. For me, I mean, the thing, like the process of science to me, like the more, you know, it's funny because like the thing that I learned the most is how much I don't know. Yeah. And like for every one thing I find out, there's like umpteen billion things I realize I don't know. And, you know, there's something about that that is so exciting to me, right? It seems counterintuitive, it's like you wake up on Christmas morning and you go under the tree and you open up, you know, a box, right? And then that box, right, there's a little bit of a present, but there's another box in the box. And so he's like, oh, okay, this stuff is cool, but what's in this other box? And you open up that box and there's like, you know, some other little trinkets, and you're like, oh, this is really cool. But then there's another box in that box, and it's just endless boxes inside of boxes, each of which has their own little prize, but each of which also has another box in it. Right. And it just keeps going like that forever. And it's, for me, that process
is one of my favorite metaphors I've ever heard, not just for science, but I feel like when I'm living life right, yeah. that's what it, even when I'm sad, even when things hurt, then it's still every box I open, there's a new box under it. Like it never stops. Yeah.
It's turtles all the way down, dude.
And I feel like that's evolution too, right? It never stops.
Exactly.
So quickly, exactly. While we're talking, I want to know two things. And one is, how do humans impact evolution? But I also want to know why that gets you so excited.
So I'll give you a few examples. And I think they all get me excited for different reasons. So one of the big goals of my lab is to understand how cities drive the process of evolution. So we've been looking at the evolution of lizards, this one specific type of lizard called an anolis lizard that lives in the Caribbean. And we're looking at essentially how it's evolved to adapt to city life, right? It's evolved longer limbs because it uses buildings instead of trees. It has like bigger toe pads that help it to grip the super smooth surfaces of buildings instead of tree bark. They're much more heat tolerant to deal with these higher city temperatures. And that's really exciting to me because, you know, when you're thinking about, like, fundamentally speaking, like what a lizard is, right? It's like all of these things that have been driven its evolution, especially this one particular group, right? They, you know, it's a radiation of 400 some odd species, and everything that we know about this radiation is about how they deal with the things that they're climbing on, and then how hot or cold a temperature that they can withstand, right? Those two things that have, you know, together in different combinations have produced 400 different species.
Wow. It's like really just that?
Yeah.
That's wild.
And then, you know, that and just like landing in different islands, right? It's like those processes. So then to take this thing that, you know, has like, you know, shaped this like really big swath of, you know, the tree of life, you know, a pretty decent swath of the tree of life, and then actually be able to look at those processes play out, you know, in the course of like years or months, right? That to me is really exciting. But that's because I'm a lizard nerd. But there are other examples. You know, for instance, you know, we are looking at the evolution of alligators in polluted waters in the South, in Florida. These waters that have been contaminated by endocrine disrupting compounds, which, you know, affect development, sexual maturity, all of these different things. And we're also looking at the evolution of wolves in Chernobyl, trying to understand how they are responding to radiation.
Cool as hell.
It is super cool. It's really interesting, you know. And again, like I always describe my research program as depressing but fascinating, And in that case, right, the lens goes both ways, right? Because the question is, how have we affected the process of evolution? But then the flip side of that coin is, how can their evolution help us to understand ourselves? Right. So like way back in like the 1900s, there's this dude named August Crow who, he had this, this quote he wrote, it was like, for every, medical question that humans have, there is some animal or suite of animals for which that question is best studied. And that's just based on this principle that evolution by natural selection has produced all of these extreme forms. And a lot of times the forms that they have produced, it has been to respond to the things that cause a lot of the different diseases that we have, right? So understanding how evolution plays out in those scenarios, right, could help to inform, our own medical technology and, and help to prevent and treat diseases. And this basically became the foundation of what's called evolutionary medicine. And in the case of these alligators evolving in these polluted waters in the South, right, these endocrine disrupting compounds, these are pesticides. These are the things that we've been spraying on our food for Lord knows how long, right? These are the things that contaminate our waters. I mean, the same waters that these alligators live their life in, their neighborhoods, right? People live, in these same environments. And we know that we suffer from endocrine disrupting compounds as well, right? We get, the contamination that affects these, these gigantic reptiles also affects us. But it just so happens that they, strangely enough, are actually a really cool and actually in a lot of ways the perfect model for understanding human-specific issues, because we are really long-lived animals, right? And the doses that we're getting of endocrine-disrupting compounds are relatively small. It's like chronic exposure over a long period of time. That's really hard to study in a mouse or, anything that you would typically keep in a lab. Alligators live for 50-plus years, right? They're vertebrates just like we are. Their endocrine systems are pretty much the exact same. Their estrogen is chemically identical to ours. And they're exposed to like these complex mixtures of endocrine disrupting compounds that are contaminating the exact places that are contaminating us. All right. So they become this really interesting model system to try to understand if evolution by way of natural selection has made them better at functioning in this specific type of environment, then the solutions that evolution has come up with in that scenario may help to inform how we treat the same conditions in ourselves.
So it's like using them almost as the test case.
Yeah.
Finding whatever their R&D was.
Exactly, right? They're the gargantuan, scaly canaries in the coal mine.
Does that give you hope? Does all of this give you hope for maybe not personal? I know you said you're an optimist, but you're sort of a nihilistic optimist, you said. But does the fact that things do change, and I mean to quote what everyone wants to quote when they're talking about evolutionary biology, that life seems to find a way, does that bring you any kind of hope when you're lying awake at night?
It does, but probably not in a way that would satisfy most people. Right? Because the thing is, I mean, life will likely find a way, right? We are much more, I think it's much more likely that we kill ourselves off this planet than we kill absolutely everything else. And we see that, life has found a way, right? In the midst of like five ridiculous extinction events that has wiped out over 90% in some cases of life on the planet. I mean, there's still the whole reason why we are here as a species, right, is because of the last extinction event, right? If it wasn't for the last extinction event, like, I mean, there would still be gargantuan reptiles roaming around, this planet. So after we're dead and gone as a species, life will likely find a way. But what that way is, like what that means and what that looks like, is probably going to be something fundamentally different than we know now if we continue going down the path that we're going on, right? So I mean, are elephants still going to be around? If we keep doing what we're doing, likely not. You know, are most of the animals that, you know, that we have read about in children's books and our children are reading about in children's books, are they going to be around? Likely not, but something will. Right? And that something will be tied to us in the same way that, you know, everything that's alive now and dinosaurs and everything that came before them is tied to us through this one string of evolution. It gives me some sense of optimism, right? It's like, it may not look the same, right? And it may be a tragedy in and of itself, but the story is going to continue.
That is beautiful. And I think that's where I want to end. I think that's where I want to end the interview. Professor, doctor, host, podcaster Shane, where can people find your work?
So you can find my research. So I've done several videos for the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, HHMI, which you can find on YouTube if you type in science of an extreme athlete. Tuskless Elephants of Gorongosa, you will likely find me and like a bit of both of those stories. And then you can also give me a listen at the Biology of Superheroes podcast, which is everywhere you get podcasts.
Do you want to say what that podcast is really quick?
Yeah. So in the Biology of Superheroes, basically it is a podcast about thought experiments where we use comic books, science fiction, in some cases fantasy, as thought experiments to get in depth and explore some aspect of biology.
All right, guys, thank you for listening. I hope this made your quarantine just maybe a little bit more hopeful. Life will find a way, and it might look different, and it might be a tragedy in its own right, but the story will continue. I am Alex Schiffman, and you can find this podcast wherever podcasts are listened to. You can also find me on Instagram, Twitter, at AF Schiffman. You can also find my show that I'm producing with Russell and Dylan, Science the Show. We're on YouTube, Instagram, Twitch, Facebook. Find us, and you can watch some stuff that Shane has done. He's a fantastic science communicator, and we also have a whole bunch of other amazing scientists who we want to bring to you. Thank you for listening, and I hope you have a good day. Bye.